At mid-afternoon, on a dying late summer day, the stunningly beautiful Deborah Davis climbed into the snazzy two-seat Mercedes convertible that her boyfriend had bought for her and drove away from the home they shared in the suburb of Randolph, Massachusetts. She headed north, her destination South Boston, East 3rd Street to be exact, to a house located on the eastern side of the compact neighborhood shaped like a finger sticking out into Boston Harbor. Her boyfriend, Stevie Flemmy, wanted to show her something. At least that's what he'd said on the telephone. He wanted to give her a tour of the Cape-style house he'd bought for his parents. The closing was earlier that very same day, and Stevie had paid the full purchase price of $80,000, an act of generosity so that his parents would not be saddled with a mortgage. Debbie exited the interstate. She began snaking her way through the streets of a community known as mostly Irish-American, insular and famous for its Southie pride. While she was familiar with the neighborhood, able to navigate the grid of narrow streets, many of which were one-way and dizzying to outsiders, if Stevie had been at the wheel, he would have been able to make his way blindfolded. Stevie Flemmy had grown up in another part of Boston, but Southie was now a key venue for his business interests. Ever since 1974, when he signed on with a gathering force in the city's underworld, the legendary boss of Southie's Irish mob. Debbie and Stevie had been together for that long, too. She was a teenager in late 1974, working behind the counter at a jewelry store on Beacon Street in Brookline, when he'd spotted her. Stevie was significantly older. Debbie was 19, he was 40. Stevie had liked what he saw. The flowing blonde hair, the blue eyes, the glamour of a ravishing young thing, and decided she was for him. He paid for her divorce from a brief mistake of a marriage, and the two were off and running. But at her age, 7 years was a long time to be in a relationship. Debbie had met someone else and wanted out. Stevie didn't think so. He wanted in, now and forevermore. An unmistakable tension had surfaced between the two. Making her way down East 3rd Street, Debbie pulled up to the curb outside the house numbered 832. She could see that the 1.5-story cape Stevie had bought was positioned oddly. The front of the house did not face the street the way most houses do. It sat sideways, and it stood opposite another house that was its mirror image. Two houses facing each other with only a small shared yard separating them. Someone standing at the kitchen sink of one house could practically reach out to hand a cup of sugar to the neighbor standing at the window of the other. The houses were, in fact, built as a pair in 1965. A year later, a 32-year-old state representative named Bill Bulger bought one. Ever since, Bill, his wife, and their growing family had lived at 828 East 3rd Street. When the twin house came onto the market in 1981, Stevie made his move. He'd talked to Debbie about wanting his parents to be nearer to him and to be safe. They'd recently been mugged in Boston. The house for sale at 832 East 3rd Street, situated in his South Boston stomping grounds and next to the home of Bill Bulger, a rising power in Massachusetts politics, certainly satisfied Stevie's idea of a safe haven. Debbie Davis waited in her Mercedes. The day that began in bright sunshine was now mostly cloudy, with cooling temperatures and a quiet breeze. Soon enough, Debbie saw Stevie's car coming down the street. She saw that Stevie was not alone. Stevie had arrived with the older brother of neighbor Bill Bulger, James J. Whitey Bulger, the city's most menacing and beguiling gangster, a crime boss who embraced the role as slayer-in-chief, in large measure because he understood that hands-on viciousness created the footing for him to rival leaders of the larger, more organized La Cosa Nostra. That Whitey Bulger also seemed to find pleasure in the terror only added to his monstrous aura. Debbie Davis should have run for it, but she did not.